Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to another episode of All Things Policy. I am Pranay and today I have with me Anupam. And Anupam, we are going to discuss something very interesting and something quite connected to the state of Karnataka.
Yeah, Pranay.
Anupam, first, before we talk about something related to today's topic, I just wanted to tell you, you teach so much about economic reasoning to your classes in public policy and all the students. So tell me one thing, we'll just discuss a couple of questions and then we'll tie that into today's topic. Okay. So first of all, tell me what happens when property rights are taken away. We always emphasize the importance of property rights, right? So what happens when they are taken away?
Yeah. So I think let's just take one step back and say that property rights are probably the most important thing that a government is supposed to do, or state is at least supposed to do, in order to let markets function. So without property rights, markets cannot function. So then what do you think, you know, in terms of importance? I think that is probably the most important function of the government, according to economists at least. I mean, of course, there are various other things in terms of defense of the land, etc. But in terms of allowing markets or letting markets function, I think property rights are probably the most important aspect of government function. So within which, I mean, you can think of, you know, four broad kind of components of property rights. Let's say, you know, the ability to use a good, the right to earn income from that good, then the right to transfer the good to others or alter it or destroy it, as that is, you know, completely seize the ownership of that particular good. And then, you know, the final bit is the right to enforce property rights. So all these things together becomes, I think, collectively what you would think of bundle of rights, which makes market tick. So the last one, which is the right to enforce property rights, is, I think, the most important aspect of all of this, right? I mean, this is collectively all these four things are what you would call as economic freedoms. And property rights is, again, right up there in terms of the most basic kind of economic freedoms. Now, what would happen if you don't have property rights? I think you'll not have an incentive to do any of these things, right? I mean, you're completely removed from the incentive to look after that property. So if, you know, just technically speaking, let's say I have a tree, or let's say, I mean, since we're talking about trees later on, but let's say I have even a plot of land in front of me. And if I'm assured that that land belongs to me, and I have a piece of paper that says this belongs to Anupam, then I'm going to look after it, make sure no one steals from it. I'm going to make sure that the weeds are cleared out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And then, of course, I will try and make a profit out of it, grow something on it, lend it to builders, and so that they can grow an apartment complex, et cetera, whatever. But having that property right will give me the incentive to look after that property. That's broadly, I mean, probably a convoluted kind of introduction to property rights, but there you have it.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is important. So, if you don't have this, then there's no incentive to produce any of the products that you can get from that particular property, right? And it might not just be land, it might be intellectual property, it might be anything, right?
Anything, yeah.
So now let's go to the second question. Okay, we always talk about, anticipating unintended consequences. So what are the unintended consequences of excessive government interventions like bans, or, you know, it's very strict licensing, etc.? What are some of the common ones?
Yeah, we think we know the answer to this one, right? When the cost of compliance gets too high, then you would rather not get either, you know, one, you would rather not undertake in that activity at all. So if I have to fill up 10 forms in order to do one simple activity, and from which the profit is not going to be that high, then I would rather not do that activity at all. But on the other hand, if let's say the activity is still beneficial, whatever that activity, economic activity might be, but this is becoming a major hindrance, regulations of or government compliance mechanisms, then I will basically go underground. That is, I will not even register it as an activity. I will try and hide it from the government, and I will make it as a completely underground thing. So essentially, you will have underground economies that will come out because you have excessive regulation. I'm sure, I mean, you have seen multiple, you run a newsletter as well called Anticipating the Unintended, and many of the things that you cover are exactly this. You have one example that you want to take up today.
Yes. So the reason why I asked you to answer both these questions is because these two very fundamental concepts come together in this idea of sandalwood. Okay. Right. This wood, which is called Srigandha, right? In Kannada?
Yes. And yeah, by the way, Karnataka has the title of Gandha the Gudi, that is the land of sandalwood. I mean, that's how important it is to Karnataka as part of its local folklore and culture and so on. There's Rajkumar song on this as well. But yeah, carry on.
Yeah, the film industry is called sandalwood.
Exactly,
man.
Yeah.
Yes, that's how important it is. Okay, so anyway, so the fascinating story about sandalwood is it is closely tied to both taking away property rights and the unintended consequences of excessive government intervention. Okay, and that's what I wanted to pick up. Before I go into the theory of it, one small anecdote I have to say. Basically, first time I visited southern part of India was in 1992 as a really young kid. And at that point of time, we went to Mysuru. And in Mysuru, my parents bought sandalwood from some small shop. Okay, and it turns out that that sandalwood was actually just a piece of wood which was scented on top. And once we went home, we realized it's useless.
No, I think this story perfectly reflects the entire story of sandalwood in Karnataka, which I think our listeners will get to know as we go on.
Yes. So this quite perplexed me, right? Like, why the hell is a wood being given in this way? And we don't have sandalwood or what, right? Anyway, so then many years later, I got some better answers to that. So let's discuss about that. Okay, now let me tell you the market scenario of sandalwood, which is really mind-boggling. Okay, so sandalwood is one of the plants which is endemic to India. So there are very few places in the world which grow this, and India is one of them. Karnataka, Tamil Nadu, and Kerala are three places where sandalwood grows a lot. Okay, so these are three states which make bulk of the production of India. Now, the interesting thing is the production of this particular, it is a very pricey commodity, right? And it is used for a lot of religious functions, etc., during weddings also, etc.
It is
quite important to all of us.
Yeah, it has both spiritual value and commercial value as well. Let's not forget that. Spiritual value, as you said, in pujas and religious functions, etc. But commercially, it's used in agarbattis, it's used for making soap, it's used for making perfumes like attar and so on. So there's various kinds of usages for sandalwood. I think it goes also into some parts of Ayurvedic medicine and then, of course, handicrafts and so on. So this is, I mean, a whole bunch of things that sandalwood is used for, and therefore it commands quite a high value and price in the market.
Right. And given that India is one of the few places where this grows, we would expect that its production will grow over time and a lot of people will make money out of this, right? But turns out that India is going exactly in the opposite direction. So I have a few numbers for you. So in 1965 to 70 period, okay, during that time, the annual production of sandalwood in India stood at 4,000 tons a year. Okay. Now, by 1999, 2000, it had fallen by half. And by 2019, you wouldn't believe it, it is just 200 tons.
Wow, that's less than 10%. I mean, that was about 5% of what it was in 1965.
Yes.
You would have probably expected the exact opposite. I mean, you would have probably expected a 500 at least cumulative growth over the next 30, 40 years, right?
Exactly. And the world has gotten more prosperous. India has gotten more prosperous. I'm sure we do more religious ceremonies than we used to do 50 years back. So you would expect that the production would also increase, right? But by the way, the global demand has increased. Okay. Now global demand is around 6,000 tons a year. And out of which India is just producing 200 tons.
Yeah, and there are other countries which do it as well. I think that's what, because India has been not able to match this global demand, other countries have opportunistically taken this up, Australia being one of them. And they've opportunistically taken this up and in fact are producing more than us.
Yeah, so that's the interesting fact, right? So now there is a huge demand for this and India is just producing 200 tons. Now, why that is so, we'll discuss later. In the meanwhile, countries like Australia, by the way, Australia had its own native sandalwood, but it wasn't of that greater quality. So they shifted to the Indian variant in 1998. They basically imported a few saplings and then created their own sandalwood forests of the Indian variety. They also introduced genetically engineered high yield varieties, and they became a huge producer of the Indian variant of sandalwood itself. Okay, and now we've reached a stage where as an input for India's own sandalwood oil industry, we import the Indian sandalwood from Australia.
Wow, talk about irony, huh?
Yeah. So this is fascinating, right?
Before we get on to Pranay, before we get on to what exactly is happening now and why has India's production kind of reduced so much, I think it's also fascinating to read about the history of sandalwood as you have written about it. Can you just take us through that? I mean, this goes back to what, Tipu's times?
Yeah. So I read this first in this article that Dr. Govind Rao had written in the Hindu. This is an old article, 2002 or something. So that talked about a lot of these things. So first of all, Tipu Sultan declared sandal a royal tree. Okay. And basically monopolized sandalwood trade in 1792. Okay. And subsequently, all governments pre-independence, post-independence have just continued this policy of monopolizing sandalwood trade.
Wow.
Okay. So this is the most interesting part, right? I mean, the history of bad sandalwood, stupid government policies goes back up till 1792.
Right. And it's not really changed since 1792, right? Because even after that, in post-independent India, I think wherever a sandalwood tree was, it belonged to the government. So even if I had a sandalwood tree in my own land, which I had, it would still technically belong to the government of Karnataka. Correct?
Yes. So that's a fascinating thing. Imagine you have something growing in your garden, but that doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the government. Okay. So even when the sandalwood tree, suppose it was on your private land, it belonged to the state government. And as an owner, you were required to make a declaration on the number of trees that you have on your land.
It can't get more bureaucratic than this. Okay.
Yeah. No, it does. That's the fascinating thing. Okay. It does. So any forest officer could enter your private land and then cut the trees, and the range forest officer would give you 75% of the value as decided by him.
Wow. Right. Okay.
So, then it gets even stranger. Okay. Then this is about growing sandalwood, right? Then you also talked about in property rights, there is also one component of you being able to sell or use that particular commodity, right? So there also there were restrictions. In Karnataka and Tamil Nadu both, in order to sell, store and process sandalwood, it was then necessary to get a license.
Of course.
And possession of sandalwood in excess of 20 kg was an offense. So you could be booked for that. Okay. So this was this. So, I mean, no doubt that because of these perverse incentives and the fact that you have zero property rights on sandalwood, the production just took a downfall, right? And that's why you see it went from 4,000 tons in around 1965 to 200 tons in 2019.
Yeah, that's the classic when you have excessive regulation, you will have, as we kind of spoke about, one is shortage because people will prefer not to just do it. But also you would have had the underground markets that we spoke about. Black market, smuggling, all of the other evil things would come out, right?
Absolutely. So that is the second order effect, right? First order is no one grew that particular sandalwood. No one took care of it. The trees just lied there because government was the one which owned it, right? So that was a direct consequence. The production fell. The second one was that all these perverse incentives actually also led to an emergence of a thriving black market. And everyone in Karnataka and Tamil Nadu knows about the brigand Veerappan, right? And the fact that in fact, whenever you see someone who's a smuggler, you can be sure that there is a bad government intervention story behind that particular smuggler, right? So is the case with Veerappan as well. So the government could, first of all, because the production fell, the demand still existed, the price of sandalwood skyrocketed, which made it very lucrative for someone to actually smuggle this particular commodity, right? So that's an incentive for a smuggler to start smuggling this particular quantity. Okay. Then also what happened is the government used to grow some of the sandalwood in its forests. So people like Veerappan used to go and plunder those forests, take those things away. That also happened. The third thing which happened was that the government then created a large army of forest guards and personnel to protect these government forests. And then you can very much imagine that when this happens, there's a collusion of forest staff with smugglers, which further caused sandalwood to vanish away.
Okay, so that's perfect. Let's just recap what has happened here. They wanted to essentially protect a particular species of a plant, correct? And now what they've done is, because of the regulation, one, the number of people who are growing it reduced, overall supply of this particular product reduced, that is, the even just purely the number of trees reduced. Then you had black market and a smuggling ring going, and then one of the most fearsome smuggler and in his own way a terrorist, in local terrorist group because of that. And then finally, you have created corruption, rent-seeking, and entire machinery that would enable smuggling. And therefore, by the way, that smuggling, once this kind of ring of smuggling started, they didn't stop at sandalwood. They started killing elephants and taking ivory and then smuggling a lot of other things as well, because you already have an infrastructure set up for smuggling, right? Why stop at only sandalwood? So that's all because of government regulation. Is that correct, Pranay?
Yes, I mean, at least significantly, we can say that it was one of the variables that made all these things possible.
Okay, but of course, the government learned from this, right? At some point, they said, I mean, Karnataka government claimed that, you know, they're learning from this and they've liberalized the sandalwood industry.
Yeah, so that's the fascinating part. So this was the story till 2001, right? And after that, as you said, the Karnataka government realized that, you know, we are actually losing out on a lot of this production has dipped significantly. We are not able to meet the demand. So they thought of liberalization. And that liberalization has another fascinating story. It also took place in typical bureaucratic state mindset. Okay. So first, what they did is that the Karnataka government said that, you know, private players can grow sandalwood on their own land. Okay. So that was the first step. Tamil Nadu also followed suit in 2002. But the condition there was that farmers could still only sell the sandalwood back to the government.
Even before that, Pranay, I did a little bit of research on my own. And there's a lot more, I think, fascinating pieces of regulation here. Okay, so first, obviously, I mean, you have... you can grow sandalwood, but you have to number the sandalwood according to whatever government regulations. Okay, so each one has to be numbered. It has to be then submitted that to the forest department. And then basically, here's the funny thing. You can't obviously cut the trees as and when you want, right? In order to cut the trees, you have to go get the permission from the range forest officer. And there are six forms that you have to fill up in order to cut the tree. Six forms, okay? So each tree, by the way. And then there is, of course, a lot of extremely rigid restrictions on when you can cut. So they say that you have to wait for it for between 10 to 15 years at least. You can't cut before that. By the way, Australia, I think they start extracting oil even at 10 years. Okay. In Karnataka, the regulation is that you have to wait 15 years before you can even extract something out of it, etc. Okay, so there's all of these set of regulations as well is there.
Yeah. Fascinating, right? So anyway, so this was what happened in 2001-2. So basically, they made it more easier for people to grow new sandalwood saplings on their own land. Okay, but they didn't change the selling part of this. Now in 2009, they made it slightly more liberal. So what they said is, you don't need to sell only to the government. You can also sell to semi-government corporations. So they said, you can sell it to Karnataka State Handicrafts Development Corporation, KSHDC, and Karnataka Soaps and Detergents Limited, which makes the Mysore sandal soap.
Right? Your favorite one.
Yes, indeed. So this is what the government did. This was their liberalization. And apparently the figure that I got from Down to Earth and a few other websites was that KSDL offers a non-negotiable sum of ₹3,500 per kg of sandalwood. And the company then turns around and sells a product for $16,000.
Wow, that's okay. That's quite a profit. Since then, changed it a little bit, but again, bought in this crazy thing about where a forest officer will decide on the value of the product and then pay 75% of that value, which was earlier, but they bought in a slightly different variant of it at in about 2009. And then, of course, a lot of people, you know, claim that this was too arbitrary and so on. And then, so what they decided after that is they'll take the average rate that is paid in both Karnataka and Tamil Nadu in the previous year and then pay that same amount. Now, of course, in both of these places, it's still the government which is deciding that rate. And therefore, you know, year on year, it's going to be more or less the same rate, right? Yeah. So that, I mean, that thing has not really changed. And of course, you can't, I mean, they put a ban on export, so you can't sell it anywhere outside. You have to sell it to these corporations.
Yeah, that's the fascinating thing. So a lot of farmers have been demanding that actually they should be allowed to sell to international buyers, right? Like why should they be first selling only within India and that too to the government and semi-government corporations? But okay, that at least has not fructified. We are still stuck with these laws. Meanwhile, interesting things happened. Countries outside India, even many states inside India saw this opportunity. And many states which didn't grow sandalwood earlier have a much more liberal take on growing sandalwood. So now you have other states like MP, Rajasthan, etc. also trying in a very small way to grow sandalwood and have a more liberal attitude towards people growing.
Yeah. Now, while they have the right policy approach, unfortunately, those states do not have the necessary kind of geographical or climatic conditions which makes, or the even soil conditions which make, you know, sandalwood grow, which is again, Karnataka, Tamil Nadu and Kerala have the best opportunity to grow. But as we've seen in what Pranay said in the beginning, the amount that we've been growing and selling has been consistently coming down, even after this so-called liberalization. I mean, it's not really, but people have not just taken up. I mean, farmers have not taken up to this offer at all because of multiple reasons. One, as we said, the regulations that you have to go through is still far too strict and far too, you know, cumbersome and burdensome that it doesn't make sense for people to take it up. And two, because of the overall kind of regime that exists, that there's such a shortage of the product and there is, you know, there already exists a nexus between forest officials and the smugglers and that there's a smuggling ring, etc. The theft is extremely high. Right? Theft of sandalwood is extremely high and therefore farmers have, I mean, if someone decides to grow this, they have to end up spending nearly 15-30% of the cost of that entire sandalwood or the value of that entire sandalwood on just security. So it's not uncommon. By the way, there's a story where there's a farmer in Mysore near Mysore somewhere where he has more than 15 security personnel that he's hired to guard the entire farm area with guns.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And there are dog squads which prevent people from smuggling sandalwood. So that's how much they have to spend on just ensuring that, you know, what they've grown is something that they can profit from.
Yeah, no, so that this is the key thing, you know, Anupam. So now, in fact, a lot of farmers who are growing this sandalwood, so the incumbents, are actually batting for the government to be the only seller here, or only buyer here. You know, because they think that because the government will be the buyer, it will then also provide some security to these people.
Right. So then you put the onus back on the government to saying, at least give me security. I'm growing this and you're going to buy it. So give us security for
exactly.
This.
So in fact, the incumbents are also not in favor of a more liberalized policy. So they do want international buyers, but very few people are batting for, you know, they are thinking, we should be thinking, what's the market failure here, right? There is no market failure. If the sandalwood price is high, that just indicates its scarcity. But in spite of the fact that there is no market failure here, we have this range of government regulations stretching back right up to 1792.
Yeah, absolutely right. And just as a final thought on this, you have, you know, new age economics and so on. Not even new age economics. I mean, it is an old idea, but people who say that if you're really interested in conservation of certain species, the best way to do that is to convert it into a pure private good. And then, you know, give property rights in order to make sure that it survives. And so if the government is really bothered about sandalwood as a particular species and conservation of that species, where, by the way, a lot of this regulation also comes from that angle that if you allow private players, they're only going to destroy it. They're going to, you know, use it for commercial purposes and the species will end up suffering. That's one angle that they come from. But in fact, that's what, if you really want to preserve the species, you give private property rights, rather property rights to private people, and then they will ensure that the species thrives, yeah, right? Because it's in their interest to do so. So that, I think, is, I mean, an approach that we should seriously consider.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, so this was today's episode. We just talked about sandalwood regulation. So I just think, Anupam, that if anyone is considering writing a book on stupid government regulations, please devote a chapter to sandalwood regulations. It does deserve a full chapter.
Yeah, and we've barely covered the surface of it. There's a lot more here, trust me.
Yes, indeed. So that's all. Thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.